Being recorded now. Okay, good. So welcome back after the break. And we'll keep going now, certainly through November, maybe one more, we'll see, four or five. Our main topic is still going to be that of wisdom. So we will be looking at different aspects of the parts of the Bible that talk about wisdom. But I seem to remember being told off 2 weeks ago that I hadn't done what I said we were going to do, which was to look at wisdom in Nehemiah. I think someone told me off for that. Yes, I can see that. So hopefully you're ready this time. But we will spend a few minutes doing that. So if you want to have your Bibles open at the book of Nehemiah, I give you the usual 2 minutes to find it, because it's one of those tricky ones that just when you think you got there, you find it's moved. But the question to ask really is, as you might ask with other people, in fact, we will a little later with someone else, is how wise do you think Nehemiah was? And you could ask that of ourselves and anybody else. And it's a tricky question, really, because it's not like there's a certain level of wisdom that you could say he has and she has more wisdom and so on. It's probably something that fluctuates and changes. It's not really a fixed reservoir in that point of view. The thing about wisdom is that you're meant to grow in wisdom, but you'll only grow in wisdom if, firstly, you recognize the need for it, and two, you actually ask God to give you it as and when you do need it. So how wise was Nehemiah? The answer is probably as wise as he needed to be. Like, how long is a piece of string sort of question, really. And obviously, when he was in Susa, to start with, just being the king's cupbearer, he probably didn't need a lot of wisdom, just to make sure he didn't spill the drink, check it was okay, not poisoned, make sure when he went into the king's presence, he didn't say something daft and end up having his head cut off or something. But it would be very routine, very comfortable, very ordinary, very straightforward. So not really a need for a lot of extra wisdom. And then, of course, his life changed completely, because he decided that he really ought to serve God in a new way, a bigger way, a more demanding way. And so he set off to Jerusalem. And from that moment onwards, the moment he decided he was going to step out from the normal and do something that really he hadn't been trained for, he probably hadn't got much of an idea about, but he got a heart for, that was the moment when suddenly he would realize, I haven't got enough wisdom for this, and I need more. So as we look through this, just picking out some of the main things, what we're really looking for is, how did he grow in wisdom? And did he always make a wise decision? It's not something we have to say, oh, of course he did. You know, he's a Bible character. He was brilliant and so on. We can also say, well, perhaps that wasn't quite as wise as it might have been. So, yeah, who we got? Rose then? John?
I don't agree that he didn't need a whole lot of wisdom as cupbearer to the king, because it was a very trusted position. And it may well be that if people were trying to bop the king off, he had to be very wise about all the politics and shenanigans that would go on behind the throne. So I think he was probably very canny and very experienced in the wiles of people who were deceitful to have survived being cupbearer to a king.
Yeah, so to me, that's probably why I was given the job in the first place. Hmm. Yeah, okay. But I still would make the point that once you leave something that you're familiar with and is routine and you've got used to that, then you're going to face all sorts of new situations that you hadn't met before. Well, let's see what he did have to cope with. It starts really when it says in chapter 2 and verse 10, we first meet these enemies, if you like, these mischief makers of Sanballat, Tobiah, and eventually there's another one, Geshem. They were much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. It's not so much that it's Nehemiah himself but someone had come, i.e. deliberately made a journey, to do something that they didn't want to happen, which was to promote the welfare of the Israelites. And at that point, they were very much disturbed, as indeed people generally might well be if, one, we decide to promote the welfare of the Jewish people, or indeed just of each other as Christians. That in itself can create a sense of trouble and problems and so on. So let's pick up what happens next. In chapter 2 and verse 19, then these three guys start to mock and ridicule them. "What is this you're doing?" they asked. "Are you rebelling against the king?" And in verse 20, Nehemiah answers them. So this is the first point in which we ask, okay, is his answer wise? Does it show wisdom? If so, in what way? Is he countering this in a way that we would say, yeah, okay, that's something to learn from? Or do we think it's worth sort of saying, I wonder quite what he did there? So how do you assess, shall we say, his answer in verse 20 to the accusations that they've just made? Betty?
Yeah, I think he based very much his response on the fact that he knew that he was, because in everything that he did, it seems to me, every step he took, he prayed to God about it before he did it, right from the very beginning to his conversation with the king, every step of the way. So he obviously had, having done that, had every confidence that his God was with him. So I think he was wise to say that.
So his opening statement there, one of confidence in God, does show that he's on the right track in that. And what about the second half of that, though? When basically he says, you lot, go away, basically. You've got no share in this. You've got no part in this. Wouldn't that just sort of stir them up even more? Is that the sort of thing we ought to say to people? Yeah. No. Someone's saying something there. Didn't hear it. Two people. Okay. I don't know whether Betty's hand is still up.
No, it's still up. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So John or Rose?
No. I was just going to say it was not a very diplomatic reply.
You're saying it doesn't sound diplomatic?
It does not sound the least bit diplomatic, no.
No, it isn't, is it? It's
not diplomatic, no.
Yeah. It's not exactly trying to win them over. It's not exactly saying, anything nice about them, really. But was he just reacting, do you think? Or was he saying something that has validity? How would they, we don't get a response from them to this. What do you think their response would have been? They didn't answer him back.
Isn't he just telling them to mind their own business?
Yeah, he is. In one sense, he is, yes.
And it isn't as if their king hadn't... I mean, that's Artaxerxes had already sent him there.
Yeah.
To allow him to do it. And it was in God's will.
Yeah.
But he's just saying, no, we're just going to get on with it.
Yeah.
But it's none of your business. You don't have any rights here.
So two things out of that. One is their accusation is actually quite more sort of undermining and powerful, because he's actually being accused of rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
They may be saying it sort of maybe politely, you don't know what the tone of voice is, but are you rebelling against the king? Now, he doesn't seem to directly answer that. It could produce the letters at this point. He could say, no, I'm exactly doing what the king has said. But by mocking and ridiculing him in that sort of way, and let's face it, this is how we could easily face being mocked and ridiculed today in our world. Are you undermining the or rebelling against the laws of the land? Are you undermining the I'm just letting someone else in. Are you undermining society by your beliefs or practices and so on? It would be easy for us to face this sort of accusation. So it was more powerful than the words might just suggest. But Nehemiah is absolutely right when he says, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or any historic right. Now, do you understand why what he's saying there is true? He's not just making something up. He's not just having a go back at them. He's actually telling them something that they would recognize as being true. Do you understand anything about that? Can you fill in any details there? Do you remember who these people were? That's back in verse 10 when it tells you.
It tells
you.
Who we got? Mary? Hello?
Well, there's an Ammonite and an Arab and a Horonite.
Yeah. And what do you know about Horonites? Anything?
No, I don't know anything about Horonites.
Well, the best sort of scholarly guess on that is that Horon was part of Moab. So he was a Moabite.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we've got Moabites, Ammonites. And some kind of Arabian from Arab. These were ancient enemies of Israel. Their hostility was particularly bad in the past because these were the people. If you remember their origins, they came from Lot's daughters. And so they were sort of like related, but not in a good way. And God gave them their own land. But when the Israelites started to come through the land, although God said, you don't attack them, the Ammonites and Moabites weren't very friendly. So God had effectively tried to separate them because of their origins. And so literally, yeah, they don't have a share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it because God has decreed that. Not because Nehemiah is just trying to say, you know, go away, you're not the right sort of people and so on. John?
Yeah, so they were actually encroaching on the territory. By being anywhere near Jerusalem at all?
Well, yeah, possibly. I mean, I don't know how they sort of spread out because after a while, their origins might have been in Moab and Ammon. But yes, they might have been because it says, first of all, they heard that someone was coming to promote the welfare of the Israelites, who, of course, were already back, quite a lot of them. So whether they just sent messages or whether they actually, you know, went nearby and that. But of course, they're not even saying, let's help you then, are they? They're not saying, oh, we've come across to offer you a friendly hand and so on. And then they're being shoved away by Nehemiah. But Nehemiah is making it very clear, we are God's servants and you have had no share in this in the past. So you're not going to get a share now. That's what you're thinking. Because if they did try and join in, they'll just use that to undermine things further. So, Pat?
I agree with Rose in that it's not, what he says is not a diplomatic reply. But what it is that it's the truth. And it's probably the best way to answer that is by the truth.
Yes. And that's probably why they have no further response or reply themselves, because they can't deny it, really. he sort of got them. So I would say, if we're trying to assess Nehemiah's wisdom, I think he's done okay here. He started off by referring to the God of heaven, is the one that's given them success. And he doesn't answer directly the accusation of rebellion against the king. But he points out that basically these accusers are not in any position to really make an accusation. So Would he have been expecting this kind of opposition when originally he said in Susa, I'm going over to Jerusalem, I'm going to do this? Or did he not know about this until he arrived, in which case that was the first time when he had to sort of realise, oh, well, this is what I'm involved in now, is it? So on.
Well, the fact that he went at night, didn't he, with a few people?
When he inspected the walls, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, might indicate that he felt that that might be better to, you know, to do it at night. Not that he was intimidated, because he proved that by his answer to them.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, he's basically just got there. He spent 3 days just sort of resting and recovering after a long, long journey. And then he did go out at night time, presumably that just means after dark, to make a bit of an inspection before he started saying, we're going to rebuild this. And I think that's wise that he decided he'd better have a good look, because he'd heard reports from Hanani and so on that there's trouble here. And so he set off knowing that Jerusalem was in disgrace and so on. But when he got there, he decided he'd better have a look himself. He didn't come with a plan already made. Right, chaps, we're going to do this, this, and this. He had a good look round. And then he said to the people, right, this is what's going to happen. And we've got God's blessing upon it. And the king has also said yes to all this. And so they began to do the rebuilding. And notice that it's when they began the rebuilding, the good work in verse 18, that's when the enemies heard about it and up to their level of attack. Now, we had a hand up a moment ago. Has it gone down?
I did. I was going to mention about Hanani, but you mentioned it. That
yeah.
Hanani okay. came and gave him the report yeah. and said that people were in distress and reproach. So I think he would have gone expecting trouble.
Yes. Yes. Alison?
Wasn't the high priest actually related to these two?
To one of them, yeah, Tobias.
But I think also he... There was another relationship he had, one of his grandsons or something, with Sanballat that married his family.
Yeah, that comes up right at the very end, because we're going to see that these issues never totally go away.
Yeah.
So it didn't send them packing and we never hear of them again. That's the point. It maybe dealt with it for a while so they could then get on with the rebuilding and so on. Let's look at the next bit of contention that he has to do. That's chapter 4. and now it's the same guy again, Sanballat this time. But this time he's incensed. So his ridicule and his previous taunts hadn't really got very far. So now the wall's actually being built up quite a bit. So there's even greater intensity now. And he seems to have got his mob with him now, if you like, the presence of his associates in the army of Samaria. This is the opening of chapter 4. So the ridicule now seems to build up, and Tobiah joins in as well. And when you come to verse 4 again, 4 and 5, this is Nehemiah's response to this. So same question, how much wisdom did Nehemiah show in his reply in verses 4 and 5 to what they were saying now in verses 1 to 3 of the opening chapter? What have we got here, John?
Isn't it his prayer to God?
Yeah, so he turns to God, yeah. So that's a tick in the sort of wisdom bit, yeah? Yeah, he's not talking back to them. Sorry, did I say that? I don't know whether I did.
No, you didn't.
Okay, but it's his response anyway to this.
So
you're making the good point that his response is to turn to God. Now, what about, therefore, his actual prayer? again, is this the sort of thing we want to hear in our prayer meetings today, do you think?
Again, he's back to not being very diplomatic.
He's now not very diplomatic towards God. Okay.
Make it in the State Department, no.
Right. But actually, that little phrase that he uses there, turn their insults back on their own heads. I don't know if that's familiar to you at all, but it sort of resonates with things that I hear in the Old Testament in other places. It's basically give them back what they're wanting to do to us. In other words, let them suffer as they are wanting to make us suffer. And that has always seemed in the Old Testament to be a typical sort of retribution type thing. Pile it on their heads instead. Betty?
Yes, it's just another way of saying let your justice reign, isn't it?
So it's not a matter of forgive them, Lord, or show them mercy and so on. It is let them have it back, let them have what they deserve from that point of view. But he does lay it on pretty thick, doesn't he? Elizabeth?
Yeah, I think it's good. I think we need to be more bold like this, more direct. I think it's a good example for us to come out of our shells or whatever and, you know, be more bold for the Lord.
And do you think, therefore, God answers that prayer, or did he answer it in this case? I mean, it's one thing sort of petitioning God to deal with our enemies, but sometimes we might just have to recognize that God is saying, actually, I want to be a bit more merciful than that, or a bit more forgiving. And really, then what do we do? Do we then tell God off that he's not doing his job properly, so to speak? Again, there's no follow-up response to this. We don't know how God responded to this. Again, we do know that this didn't finish them off completely. The enemies were still going to be there. So give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. And that sounds pretty sort of devastating and sort of final. But whether that actually happened, I don't have any idea about that. Betty?
Yes, I think the whole point of going there and to build up the walls and the temple is to glorify God. And I think that we're quite within our rights to pray for God's name to be glorified. I think in everything that we ask for, that's the point of our prayers, is that he's going to be glorified.
So really, this attack on them is seen as an attack on God himself. And so when it's, what are these feeble Jews doing and all the rest of it, it's actually meant to be saying that your God isn't up to much either.
It reminds me of Hezekiah when he was attacked as well.
Right.
He had the same kind of attitude in some of his prayers. But I think it's a proclamation. It's making a proclamation, and it's faith, isn't it? He's demonstrating his faith in God.
And he is leaving it. He is leaving it with God, isn't he? Mm-hmm. He's actually not saying, "Oh, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that." He's asking God to deal with it, and then presumably he has to leave it with God for him to decide. I like the idea of being, should we say, bolder in prayer, but it doesn't sound very Christian. That's the point, really. Mm-hmm. But there we are. Now, what happened next is that, from verse 7 onwards, the attack, if you want to call it that, intensifies even further, because this time they begin to plot. This is verse 8. They plotted, and you notice back in verse 2, Sanballat has got the army of Samaria there, because he's either the governor of the place or is some kind of army commander, or maybe a mixture of both. So he's now got all his army there to help. So when they plot together to come up and fight, it doesn't mean just two or three of them. It means lots of people are going to come up against Jerusalem and stir up trouble.
Yes.
And the problem that then that has is that the people in Judah doing the work start to get a bit more frightened, because now they realize that there's physical danger, And they're sort of almost psychologically now being defeated. Because verse 12 is interesting when it says the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, which is a phrase for meaning repeatedly, lots of times, doesn't matter if it's 10 or not. They're beginning to feel the pressure of what's going on. You know, we're going to come, we're going to kill you, we're going to deal with the situation, we're going to put an end to the work. And at this point, it's not just Nehemiah feeling that he's just being mocked and ridiculed a little bit, it's affecting the whole people. So now he needs another boost of wisdom, if you like, in order to work out how to counter the problems that they're all facing at this point. So again, when you read on, see what he does or says or both, where's the wisdom in this then? Is he developing more wisdom to cope with this more intense situation? Yes, John.
Well, I suppose the first thing is he's not going to quit building the wall, and he doesn't want anybody else to quit building the wall.
Yeah.
So that's the start, and then the other bits follow on behind there, which is quite interesting approach, really.
But
I think that's the key, isn't it? That he wasn't going to quit.
Absolutely, yeah. He's certainly very determined and all that. Anything else on this, and Betty?
Yeah, he was wise in a couple of instances. First thing he did, he placed the guards around on the undefended parts, which would quieten down some of the fears.
Yeah.
And then he reminded them that God's in charge. So he didn't actually, feeling that God was in charge, he didn't actually need to do that, but he did that to help allay their fears, but then said to him, well, you know, we're okay because God's with us.
So he both produced what you might call defense and attack. He defended the place, he put the guards around. And again, if you look at the details of what he did, again, it seems very sensible that the way the officers posted themselves behind the people of Judah, those who were building the wall, and some people kept building, other people had the swords in their hands, and they had a watchman, a trumpet, ready to blow should they need it. And it actually meant that they could continue the work day and night. And you also get this strange idea that they never seem to take off their clothes or have a wash or something. Basically means that they weren't distracted or deterred from doing this. But at the same time, as a wise, practical approach to it, he's still turning to God, isn't he? And he's reminding them, verse, is it 14, remember the Lord who is great and awesome. So he's telling the people, just remember who we're doing this for. Just remember what our God is like. And later on in verse 20, he says, our God will fight for us. So he's using truth as a weapon. He's bringing truth to the fight and the situation and reminding people, you know, don't take your eyes off God. Don't look at the enemy. Don't look at all the things that they're threatening. And did it work? Did it work? Look at verse 15. It seems to work very well. Because the enemies basically gave up. Or they certainly, the attack that they were preparing for and that they were preparing to defend against never happened, did it? Didn't happen at all. So that sense it didn't happen, and the enemies became aware that God really was on their side in some way. He was frustrating it. Perhaps the prayer of verses 4 and 5 had come into play, and God had done something, and they recognized that God was frustrating them in that respect. So it did seem to work. John?
Yeah, it's kind of like they had prepared for a surprise attack, but they were found out.
Yeah.
As it were, because there were Jewish people living out in the countryside, not in Jerusalem, who had heard of it. And the net result was they saw they couldn't undertake a surprise attack, and therefore they they give up, at least at that point.
Yeah, because it says when they heard that we were aware of their plot. So that's the first thing that scuppered it for them. You're right. I saw another bit somewhere a moment ago. Something like that. Yeah, verse 11, the enemy said, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them. So, yes, they were planning something of that kind, surprise. And when they realised that they'd lost that element of surprise, then basically they gave up. They were too cowardly to take control of things. So I think, again, Nehemiah has grown in wisdom. He's dealing with things, if you like, in his own heart properly, but also now with the people. He's got to step up when it comes to leadership and making decisions of this kind, because this is really where wisdom comes to the fore, when you've actually now got to make decisions that otherwise you would never have dreamt you had to make. And that's always a big test. And that's when you need to cry out for wisdom. There's some more problems in chapter 5. We won't go into detail, it's the whole chapter, but you may, by glancing at it, realise that he's now got internal disputes to deal with, because this time it's not an enemy from outside, it's an enemy from within, because they're saying, basically, some of our own people are exploiting us. And so there's a great outcry of brother on brother, if you like, Jewish person on Jewish people, including the women and the children are involved as well. So suddenly the whole project, if you like, is under threat because of internal strife, disunity, dissent. This shows really that the enemies are not just the human enemies that are outside the city, but it's the attack of the spiritual enemy, if you like, the forces of evil that love to stir things up against them, against each other, and stop the work of God that way. So we'll have to think exactly what Nehemiah does about that in a minute, but it's got a different problem to contend with now. Betty?
Yeah, it just made me think, as you were saying that, Paul, I mean, if you sort of treat this whole situation as our situation at the moment, in the church, I mean. And what have we got? We've got people arguing against each other about whether it's right to vaccinate, whether it's right to do this, whether it's right to do something else. So apart from all the other stuff we got going on outside, we've got this potential problem sort of ripping everybody apart within the church.
Yeah. So and you might ask the question, I wonder why Nehemiah didn't realise this anyway. Was he so busy working on the wall that he didn't see what was happening under his nose, so to speak, with the way people were treating each other? Because he took a great outcry for people to suddenly say, this isn't right, something's going wrong here. Because then it says in verse 6, when I heard their outcry, then he did something. And again, we're now looking at, was he wise in his response to this? And the first thing was his emotions, or his feelings on it, was, again, very angry. And this is the equivalent sort of level of anger that Sanballat and the others had when they heard that the walls were being rebuilt. Remember, they said they were incensed by it. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to promote the welfare of the Israelites. And now this is happening, and it's Nehemiah's turn to be very angry. Now, I'm sure we know that there's always times when we are allowed to be angry. We call it righteous anger. But what's the first thing he did, though, when he got very angry, really hot under the collar? What does it say he actually did?
With himself.
Yes, exactly. Before he says or does anything, he says, my version is he pondered these things. But it literally means he took time out to have a good old think about it. And it's almost like he had a debate internally with himself. Before he spoke out loud, he decided he would have a talk with himself on this. And then once he'd done that, once he realised that, yeah, okay, I've counted to 10, I've thought it through, I've heard all this, I've processed it. Then he goes on the offensive and starts to accuse people. We'll see in a minute what he actually did there. But John again.
King James says at the start of verse 7, after serious thought.
Yeah.
I think summarizes it quite nicely.
Yeah, indeed. And we don't know how long that was or what exactly he had to do. Did he have to go into his little room by himself and actually, I mean, he was very angry, but you don't make the best decisions when you're very angry. You do sometimes need to just count to 10, if you like, calm down a bit, go into a darkened room and then do some thinking and then make your decisions. It's probably Caroline next.
Given that on the previous occasions it always said that he prayed, you know, I think can assume that he didn't just talk to himself, but he actually prayed.
Yeah, no doubt he was checking things out with God as well. Yes. Thank you. But then comes the accusations. Then he really sort of tears into them. Again, you know, he's a passionate sort of guy when need to be. He doesn't hold back on what he said. So he really accused, you know, the guys responsible, the nobles, the officials and all the rest of it. You're doing this, you're doing that. The main problem was extracting excessive interest from them, which, of course, was against the law and so on. And there'd even been this case of taking some of the children into slavery and was making them work for them for nothing and so on. And I think at one point he says something like, and this should not be or something. He basically tells them, you really can't do this. And the response this time, we do have a response to him at the end of verse 8. They kept quiet. They could find nothing to say. Again, Nehemiah was saying the right thing. He was speaking the truth on it. And then it's the next verse that says, what you're doing is not right. You know, he's not asking them to think about it, to work out for themselves whether they've got it right or not. This is not right, full stop. And talks about walking in the fear of God and so on and so on. And the response in verse 12, when they realized that they could find nothing in their defense, was, okay, we'll give it all back then. We will do as you say, which I think is a sign that they had understood, recognized that this was proper wisdom. It wasn't just their boss having a go at them. He was actually saying the right thing. He was speaking from God on God's behalf, if you like. And really they had no choice except to say, okay, not only will we stop doing this, but we'll give it back what we've taken that we shouldn't have done. John and Rose again.
I think this is an example of one of the places where he brought wisdom from where he'd been serving the king. These people promised that they would do something, and he said, yeah, bring the priests in here and you're going to write down an oath and everybody will see that you've done it. So nice promise, but we're going to take this to court and make sure you do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's right. There's another bit to this, isn't there? That he didn't just say, okay, I hear what you say thing. They had to take an oath to do what they had promised. And he adds to it, but very sort of fearsome language and this sort of demonstration of shaking out the folds of his robe and so on. And everybody knew that this had happened. Everybody knew about the decision. They all said amen. They praised God. And at that point, you know, they could then move on. He'd resolved the whole situation. And if this had gone wrong at this point, then they could have, you know, perhaps not have even completed the wall. Or even if they had, they probably wouldn't have had a very nice sort of environment to live in afterwards, having a go at each other all the time. So that's a different kind of opposition, different kind of wisdom, Elizabeth.
Oh, I was just wanted to say that he called the meeting, didn't he? He called them all together. He just wanted to get it all out in the open.
Yeah.
And for them all to be there.
Yeah, indeed. Together.
And I thought that was, and he obviously was a man with authority, you know, that
yes.
Use. Yeah.
It's back in verse 7, he says, I call together a large meeting to deal with them. Mm-hmm. Deal with them, not the situation, deal with them. So, yeah, he was capable of having large-scale meetings as well to sort this out. But I guess at this point he had earned a certain amount of respect because, one, he had turned up to do this in the first place. He'd gone to a lot of trouble. And he'd shown some wisdom so far in dealing with the external enemies and his tactics of protecting them and so on, that really, if he's earned their respect and shown that he's a wise governor in that respect, then they're probably more likely to say, yeah, okay then. But it doesn't end there, because we go back to our old friends Sanballat, Tobiah and Geshem in chapter 6. And now the walls have been built to the full height, the gap's closed. But now there's some very strong personal attacks on Nehemiah himself. And the first one, from verse 2 onwards, is they were trying to have a meeting with him. Let's meet together in one of the villages. This is some distance away from Jerusalem. They're trying to get him off his sort of home patch, away from his friends, if you like, and say, let's just meet together. And they don't say why, but Nehemiah immediately, his antennae twitch, if you like, he knows they're scheming to harm me. So something was happening there, wisdom, discernment, whatever you want to call it, when he was able to recognize that they weren't now saying, okay, so you built the wall, fine, let's forget it. Let's have a nice little party together in one of the places. He realized that they were still going to, in fact, probably do something really bad, just basically probably kill him, certainly harm him. And if you follow that through, how does his wisdom show through in his response to that? Mm-hmm. Obviously realizing what the situation was, not being fooled by them, suddenly sort of coming over all friendly like. But what else did he have to do that shows a certain amount of wisdom? You keep going all the way through from verse 3, 4, 5, and so on. Did his enemies take no for an answer, in other words? Betty?
He gave them a plausible reason why he couldn't go.
Well, yes, if you like, yeah.
Because it would have to be to dispute that, then they would have to take a more aggressive pose again, wouldn't they?
Yes, I mean, he saw it as a possibility that if Nehemiah left town for a while, then everybody else would down tools, at least have a break, if not to stop altogether. But the enemies were persistent, weren't they? And that might have been easy when the fourth time it came through, the same message, he thinks, oh, okay, then I'll go after all. It's easy to have your resistance broken down by a sort of repeated drip, drip, drip sort of thing. But the enemies were persistent as well. And the fifth time, this was getting a bit worse, because this time it wasn't just a little message, come and meet us. This time, that message was accompanied by an unsealed, i.e. open letter, in which it is written, and here's this accusation again, the little taunt from earlier, are you rebelling against the king, aren't you? Now they're actually saying openly, you're now planning to revolt. That's your whole purpose behind this. And that's why, now that you've got the wall nearly finished, now we'll see what you really like. And there are reports that you, Nehemiah, want to become king. So this is all about you and your glory and your position and your power. Oh, and you've got the prophets lined up ready to make this proclamation about you. So basically, come and have a talk with us, because, you know, we might send this report back to the king, Artaxerxes, and get into big trouble. But perhaps we can talk it through. But as we know, they were just planning to harm him. So even if he had fallen for that one, he would have come to harm. But his response in verse 8, wise again, I think. Explain, if you like, the wisdom in verse 8 and his words in reply.
He's standing on the truth again, isn't he?
Yeah. Nothing like what you're saying is happening. So he tells them in terms, it's all a load of rubbish, but any rumours or reports like this, they're still going to hurt. And you might be able to sort of say it's not true, but some people might start to think, mightn't they? Oh, okay, I wonder if this is what's going to happen now we've done all this. Because they're almost trying to divide Nehemiah from the people, and trying to make the people think, oh, okay, he's going to become king at the end of all this, and then we'll see him in a different light sort of thing. So it's very difficult to counter this kind of misinformation, because he's aware in verse 9 that this is all about frightening the people again. Yeah. They will give up, because if they even half believe this is true, they might think, okay, we're doing this for the wrong reasons then. If our leader really is promoting himself in all this, perhaps we better stop. So there's some real sort of seeds of discontent likely to occur here if we weren't careful. And again, he prayed, didn't he? Nehemiah turned to prayer again. Just simple, a simple prayer, short prayer. But he would have had to probably have to go around and tell everybody, don't listen to these rumors. This is not true. There aren't any prophets. There aren't any plans. There aren't any plots. We're doing this for the right reason, for God, so that we can live safely and worship him.
He also was wise, Paul, wasn't he? In as much as he was prepared to roll his sleeves up, and he worked even harder himself.
Yeah. 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 He was always there, if you like, making sure things were done, and he did his bit. Yeah. Again, you see, he must by this time he's got a good reputation. He's well respected, which hopefully is what wisdom does. It makes you respect someone. So although there's some danger of them thinking this might be true, these reports, it perhaps didn't take much for him to go around and say, look, this is all nonsense. It's not going to happen. They're making it up. But he still faces more, because the rest of the chapter is now the enemies are, I think, paying false prophets to try and do something similar, hiring them anyway to either prophesy against him or again say, let's meet in the house of God. False rumors. People are coming to come and kill you, so you better come with us. They were trying to draw him away from that. And again, his response to verse 10 is in verse 11. Again, I think, is he saying wise things? Should a man like me, meaning someone in my position, not my character, but should someone doing my job, if you like, doing what I'm doing for God here, should I run away? He might want to, but no, he's asking it sort of himself. Should one like me go into the temple to save his life? No, I won't. Okay, I'm the guy at the top. I'm not going to run away or get frightened about this. But he also realized discernment again. This was not a true prophecy. These have been hired to intimidate him, because they're trying to make him sin and therefore offend God, and therefore probably bring disgrace upon the people again, but also discredit him amongst the people. And in verse 14, once again, he has this this prayer to God, this sort of prayer of, remember them, God, for what they're trying to do, and make sure you deal with them appropriately. So so this is an example of a similar sort of attack reappearing again, same thing coming back but stronger, which often happens when we're put under attack. And I suppose the final lot, because the next chapters have got mainly good stuff in it, but we know at the very end, chapter 13, where things have gone wrong again, Nehemiah has to sort out the fact that they've broken their covenant, their oath, then gone against what they said they would do to support the house of God, and so on. And again, this time he starts to do lots of things. He still prays quite a bit, but he takes some pretty severe action against Eliashib and Tobiah. This is where we learn about the relationship with them and how Tobiah, who remember was, he was the Ammonite, he shouldn't have been anywhere near the temple, but he had been given his own place in it, and so on. He deals with it severely. I think he gives orders about it. He tells me, no, in certain terms, that's what you've got to do. And I think he gets the people to put things right as well. So again, tough action, but probably based upon the need to do this. He doesn't say on this occasion he had a little meeting with himself and worked it all out, but the moment he learnt about this, again, he was greatly displeased. His emotions came into play again, but he knew exactly what he had to do. And even later on in the chapter, when he saw that they were breaking the Sabbath and the trading rules and so on, and they were marrying foreign women, again, he took action. And again, you might think, this perhaps isn't quite in the Christian leadership manual. Yes, he rebukes them, but he also, in verse 25, calls down curses on them, beat some of them up and pulled out their hair, and then said, I'll make them take an oath, and so on. So maybe you might think, has he gone over the top a bit there? Is that the wisest thing to do? But again, he decided he had to take severe action. Otherwise, things would go from bad to worse again. John?
It's interesting that he went back to wherever he came from, Persia or whatever.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, the folk ran amok.
Indeed.
A little bit like Moses going up the mountain, yeah, to meet with God, and Aaron being, well, coerced or, yes, or involved, heavily involved in making a golden calf and all the rest of it. And again, they ran amok, didn't they? So,
yeah,
while Moses was away. It's instructive from that point of view alone, I think.
Yeah, and Aaron was, of course, Moses's brother and second in command, his trusted right-hand man, if you like. And of course, Eliashib, the high priest, should also have been trusted, the one who could, if you like, make sure things were still okay while Nehemiah was away. But he was let down by the very people that he should have been supporting him. And he also made me think of similar things happening eventually in the churches where Paul was. He established them, you know, got the converts, built up the churches, put leaders in place, taught them everything, left them. And the next thing he hears is that it's in a mess. You know, Corinth, they're all writing to him with all their problems. And he's thinking, should I have stayed? You know, or did I put the right people in charge? Why does it so easily go wrong, so quickly goes wrong? But it did. And Paul actually had to write some pretty tough stuff back to them, or even return to them in some cases in order to sort them out. Was that Caroline coming in?
Yeah, no, sorry, I put my hand up by mistake. But actually, I did want to just say something, just going back to chapter 7, if I may.
Yeah.
Because when it said, it does have to be at verse 12, when it says, then I perceived that surely God had not sent him. And I think you know, that was just sort of...
Sorry, when you put your head down, we don't hear you. So you were reading something, we didn't hear you.
Sorry. Chapter 7, verse 12, when it says that he perceived that God had not sent these people. Yeah. And I'm thinking, and I was just pondering on that.
Right.
I'm thinking, yes, you know, we've seen all through that when all these difficulties occurred, that he went to God, didn't he? He prayed and so on. He must have known God's ways. He must have known that because of what the outcome would have been if he'd taken notice of these things, these false prophets, that would have caused him to sin and so on.
Yes.
But he knew, I just felt it just so showing that he knew his God, he knew God's ways, didn't he? And that is why he was wise in his responses.
That's right. There is no substitute for that, is there? There's no other wisdom that takes the place of that. The best way to be wise is to get to know the God of wisdom better and better, to know his mind, to know what he wants. And maybe at times he overdid it a little bit. He was overzealous, shall we say, or some of his words might have been a bit tough. I'm not sure whether you meant to really call curses down on them, but then God did, in the sense of in Deuteronomy, you've got do this and I'll bless you, do that and I'll curse you. So maybe he was just repeating what God has said in the past. You know, he wasn't making up new stuff himself. And I'm not sure whether he meant to pull people's hair out, but no doubt he was pulling his own hair out at the same time as to what was going wrong. Again, maybe it's just a dramatic demonstration of what needed to be put right. So how wise was he? Well, I'm not going to give him a mark out of 10 because that's not what it's about. But I think certainly most of the time he was extremely wise, and he had to grow in wisdom as the situation developed. And as things got worse, both externally and internally, it's as though he had to really, you know, sort things out himself. And that's what leadership is about. You don't come into it fully fledged, do you, fully rounded. It's only when you're in the job, if you like, that then you have to realise what it's about. So in the end, good lessons there from him, I think, particularly as regards how to deal with opposition or problems that are thrown up. Betty?
Also, the fact that he points out the fact that this was exactly what King Solomon did. And he was wise, and he was learning from what has happened, the mistakes that happened before.
Yes, thank you. That's interesting. Thank you for that perfect link to the next bit, which is, having looked at Nehemiah, perhaps we ought to look at the wisest man there ever was, apparently, someone called Solomon. So if we ask the question, how wise was Nehemiah? And then you ask the question, how wise was Solomon? What would you say about that? What do you know about the wisdom of Solomon? And is it worth sort of criticizing it a little bit? John?
I think Nehemiah was a whole lot smarter than Solomon, because he didn't have 700 wives and 300 concubines, which would equal roughly 1,000 mothers-in-law.
Indeed, that's not helpful, yes. But, yeah, I mean, from the point of view of Nehemiah's personal integrity, he comes out a lot stronger than Solomon did. And yet Solomon is renowned for wisdom. Now, why? How? How did that come about? Betty?
Solomon actually asked for wisdom, didn't he?
He did.
He asked specifically for it, but he didn't seem to be prepared to do anything himself to become wiser.
Okay, that's an interesting point. So, okay. The question, yeah, we'll come back to that a little bit later, but let's double check we know what that's all about. It's in 1 Kings, and it starts really in chapter 3, I think. This remarkable offer by God to Solomon, who obviously being David's son was going to be favoured, if you like. So it's in 1 Kings chapter 3. It's probably also in Chronicles as well. But it's in 2 Chronicles chapter 1. But he's there at Gideon. And it says that the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream. This is verse 5, 1 Kings 3. Ask for whatever you want me to give you. And I don't know what you'd say in response to that. Have you ever had God say to you, just ask me for whatever you want and I'll give it to you? Has anyone had that experience? I guess not.
We all have, haven't we? Because it says in the Bible to ask me for, you don't have it because you don't ask me. Well, so ask me for it.
Exactly. Yeah, we're all encouraged to ask for whatever we want. Yeah. Okay. But this was certainly very dramatic and so on. So what do you ask for then? How do you respond to this? So you're a sort of young man. You're a ruler, someone with great responsibility. And you're setting out trying to, you know, sort out what life's all about in this new role he's got. And God says, ask me for whatever you want, I'll give it to you. And I don't know how long he thought about it, doesn't say. But eventually it comes down to verse 9. He actually asks for a discerning heart and to distinguish between right and wrong, because otherwise how on earth am I going to cope trying to govern this great people of yours? So, and he describes that, I'm only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. So there's all the humility that he could possibly need, and I'm here, it's your people, you've chosen them, they're very numerous. I must be feeling a bit like Moses again in the past, where there's all these people that's come out of Egypt. How is he going to cope with that? Moses needed wisdom at that point, and he got some actually from Jethro, his father-in-law, who told him how to divide things up to make sure that everybody had their problems sorted out. And he asked, therefore, for a discerning heart and what you might call a mind to distinguish between right and wrong. And he's also asking for this on the basis of God's kindness or covenant love, really, towards his father David. So here I am. I don't necessarily want to be, you know, I didn't ask for this, but I had to be born to King David, and it's now my turn. So this is what I feel I need. And of course, the Lord was very pleased with all this, because he said, you could have asked for long life, you could have asked for the death of your enemies, you could have asked for wealth and so on. So I'll give you that wise and discerning heart, so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Now, that is a big, big statement. I mean, you're going to be wiser than anyone has been in the past, and also wiser than anyone else will be. I don't suppose that excludes Jesus in that. It's just a statement for the time being, really. And you'll get all these other things as well, because you've asked for the right thing. And it just says then that Solomon woke up and realized it had been a dream. But he didn't dismiss it as, oh, that was a nice dream. It actually was a dream that was going to be prophetic and would come true. So the next thing we get in our text, just to follow this on a little bit, is we get the famous story of the two prostitutes and the one baby. You probably know this story really well. It's actually the story that made his reputation grow. So they're both arguing over whose baby it is, because one of them has lost her baby, died in the night. So one baby has survived, and they're both claiming it. So they go to Solomon, this now guy who's got this great discerning heart and wisdom to know what's the right thing to do. And the king says, bring me a sword. So they brought him a sword. And everybody must have wondered at that point, what's going on here? What's he going to do next? What's he going to say? And then he gave an order. Okay, we can't decide whose child it is, so let's split it. Split the difference, you know, half each. That sounds fair. And it seems to solve the problem, because the one who really is the mother says, no, I'd rather give my child up than have him killed. Whereas the other one, whose child it wasn't, couldn't care less, said, okay, then do it. And that was the way that he had discerned the way out of this very difficult situation. And it says, when all Israel heard the king had given, they held the king in awe because he had wisdom from God to administer justice. Now, I'll just take you briefly through that story, which you probably knew very well. But any thoughts yourself on this scenario? Does it come as a shock to us still? Does it seem something that really does display his wisdom? Is there any thoughts or comments on that particular story at the end of 1 Kings 3? John?
Just to go back, really. I mean, Solomon already had this heavy load on his head, as it were, shoulders. He was David's son and he'd been chosen as king. He got the temple to build and the houses to build and all the rest of it. And then God institutes this dream, if you like, or discussion with him. And at the end of it, he says, you're going to be wiser than anybody else. I mean, that would kind of add, I think, a little bit to, well, take away too, on the one hand, but add to your the pressures of leadership, if you like, the kingship.
Yeah.
You've got to do, there's a whole host of things that you've got to do in addition to what you'd thought already. And
so people will turn up with their issues about
difficult problems.
Yeah, exactly. Because suddenly, oh, okay, you're the one that's got all the wisdom. Then you sort it out. So yeah, the pressures of leadership is that everyone thinks that you can give all the right answers and so on. Yeah, I never thought of it quite like that. Yeah, but you're back again, John, or Rose?
It's Rose just commenting on verse 28, that the people were able to see he had wisdom from God. He wasn't just going to be a smart guy. He had wisdom from God.
Yeah.
I presume that meant they were a bit awed, I hope.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, if this was his first test of this particular wisdom that he's meant to have, I think he has come through it with sort of flying colours. But this wasn't something he had worked out in advance. It wasn't in the sort of manual of wisdom for leadership. You know, two women, one baby, what do you do? Oh, yeah, it's the sword thing, isn't it? Of course it is. Did he have a word of knowledge? Did he have a word of wisdom suddenly come to him? Did he suddenly realise, could he discern in the two women? That was the right thing to do then, whereas in another situation, it might not have been the right thing to do. In other words, you have to weigh up exactly what the outcome is likely to be, because it could have gone horribly wrong, I suppose. But his wisdom was actually the moment when he said, bring me a sword. It's as though suddenly, perhaps at that moment, he saw what needed to be done and how to go about this. So anyway, Caroline, what do you think on this?
I just want to go back to verse 9, when he's asking, when Solomon's asking for an understanding heart to judge the people, to discern between good and evil. Understanding actually got a margin note in mind that says it means hearing. So he was asking God for a hearing heart, and so hearing, presumably, to hear from God what to do in these things.
Right. And presumably, in the situation we're just looking at, with the bring me a sword sort of thing, yes, he must have heard something or discerned something that said, in this case, that's what's needed, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, it put him on a good footing at that stage. And of course, his wisdom grew and grew, so much so that eventually he had a visitor. Chapter 4, by the way, if you turn over to read more about his wisdom, this is chapter 4, verse 29. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East. That's quite a compliment. And the wisdom of all the men of Egypt. That's another compliment. That's where a lot of wisdom was established in those places. He was wiser than any other men, including lots of people we don't know about coming up. Ethan the Ezrahite, actually, you might know about. Anyone remember Ethan the Ezrahite?
From Psalms, isn't it?
He wrote a psalm, yes. So his name's there. And all these other guys, he was wiser than We don't know how wise they were, but presumably that meant something in their day. And so his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. And at the end of the chapter, men of all nations came to listen to his wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. So it spread. And eventually, of course, we had, I don't quite know which chapter this is, but chapter 10, one famous visitor, the Queen of Sheba. So in 1 Kings chapter 10, she turns up she came to test him with hard questions. She has a lot of people with her, lots of camels, lots of gifts, gold, stones, and so on. And he just says she came to Solomon and talked with him about all that she had on her mind. So there she is, one ruler coming to another ruler and saying, tell me how to do this, if you like. I'm not getting on too well back home. I'm having problems. Or maybe, I don't know, I'm making this up a bit. But the idea is that she came to talk it through with him. And then she said she saw all the wisdom of Solomon. And she said at one point, this is verse 6, the report I heard in my own country about your achievements and wisdom is true. I didn't really believe it until I came and saw them with my own eyes. But it's not even not even half was told to me. It's even more than I heard. The wisdom and wealth you have has far exceeded the report I heard. How happy your men must be. How happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. And then she praises the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel, and so on. So that sounds very nice, very flattering. Perhaps it went to his head a little bit. But as part of all that, his reputation developed. And yet, when you summarize, if you like, sum up the life of Solomon at the end with all the different things, it's not actually a life of complete wisdom, shall we say. You've already mentioned all the women that he had. And the number there is excessive, of course it is, but it wasn't just the number, was it? What's the real problem with all the women that he had?
It took him away.
Brought in their foreign gods, didn't they?
Yes, that's right. So they led him astray in terms of what he did. I think it actually says later on that he built high places for the sake of his wives. And he built high places to the god Chemosh, which was the same god as Molech, just the Moabite name. Molech was an Ammonite god. We're back to these guys again, the Ammonites and the Moabites. They're always on the edge of things, trying to stir up trouble. So here's some wives. And then once you've married them and they've got their influence on you, he set up high places to these false gods. Alison?
Weren't the people also doing that anyway? Back in chapter 3, where he asked for wisdom, they were still sacrificing at the high places because the temple hadn't been built.
Yeah.
He walked according to instructions given to him by his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burned incense on the high places. So he'd already kind of slid from what he'd been taught by David.
Yeah. So this great gift of wisdom didn't change that, really. Yeah. Betty?
Yeah, it seems almost as though he went out of his way to get the whole clutch of them, didn't he? Because it was the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Edomites, Sidonites, Hittites, all the ones that the Lord had told them that, he'd said to the children, you will not go into them, neither will they come into you. And it sounds as though he's got the job locked.
Exactly.
To get through the lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And what happened immediately after he died, of course? What happened to the kingdom?
It split.
Divided. Children, there was rebellion, if you like. They did other things. When you actually read carefully about his whole life, he did other things that a king should not have done. It's very clear in Deuteronomy chapter 17 what a king should be like. And when eventually they said, oh, we want a king, and they were warned, hey, better not, it's not really what you need, it's just God you need as your king. No, we want a king. It had already been written down in Deuteronomy 17 what a king should be like and what he should do. And one of the things that a king should do is write out a copy of the law, and presumably therefore read it, understand it, and apply it to himself. Because if he was meant to be the one at the top in the example, he was meant to have the law of God very firmly in his hands, in his heart, in his minds, and so on. And one of the things it says in Deuteronomy 17 about a king, firstly, a king must not be a foreigner himself. You had to choose a king from your own people. But equally, therefore, he mustn't marry into foreigners. It also says he mustn't acquire great numbers of horses. He mustn't make people return to Egypt for more horses. He mustn't accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. And he's not to think of himself better than his brothers or turn from the law in any way. And when you read through the life of Solomon, he did all those things, including the rather more obscure things, if you like, of sending people down to Egypt to get more horses. You know about Solomon's stables. He had a lot of horses, as though somehow that was a good thing to have. And yet he was going against what God has said. You don't go down to Egypt. Don't go back to that place just because it's tempting to do so. John?
Yes, in addition, you mentioned it already. He amassed large amounts of gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And every year there was how much? 666.
Oh, yeah. Right, yes, that number again, yes. Yeah, indeed. And it just kept coming, all this wealth and so on, because it's almost like unstoppable once you're going down that path. So even his son, Rehoboam, who succeeded him, was born to an Ammonite woman. Interesting to know whether or not Solomon himself did actually sacrifice his own firstborn children, and therefore whether Rehoboam was the secondborn or whether Solomon decided to make an exception in his case and so on. And basically, I assume that what happened in all this is he became proud of what he could do, proud of his wisdom, proud of his wealth, proud of having women and all the rest of it. It's the classic case of eventually being a friend of the world and therefore slipping away further and further from God, even though God continued to use him, and he did use him to build the temple. But actually, he didn't impress his people when he built the temple, because he used a lot of forced labor, I think, if I've remembered it right. And after he died, they appealed to his son to say, please take this great yoke burden of work from us. And his son went and thought about it and said, no, I'm going to make it even harder for you. I'm going to be even more like my dad. So he left a bad model there for the future. Well, and then, of course, the kingdom split. I noticed when the temple is dedicated, and of course, God blesses it and so on, and Solomon's there. If you read what Solomon keeps saying, it says, the temple I have built.
Oh.
Temple I have built. And he even says, the temple I have built for you, O God. Oh, okay. So Solomon's trying to take all the credit, despite the fact that he had used, I think the number is about 183,000 conscripts or forced labor to actually do it. Solomon didn't lay a finger to help at all. But it's not that, you know, God's done this. I have done this for you. And it talks about the size of Solomon's personal offerings at that time, all the tens of thousands of cattle, sheep and goats, that the altar was too small. It's as though, again, he was trying to focus on, well, look at all what I'm bringing. So he's the very opposite. It's like Jesus with the widow's mite. He's like, look at all that I've got, so I can bring all these wonderful offerings to the temple. But he's actually giving nothing really of himself. In fact, God in the end probably didn't want those sacrifices. He just wanted, he wanted his heart back again. So something clearly went wrong in all that. And in fact, another thing that he did after God had appeared to him to remind him of his need for obedience and so on, he even gives away part of the promised land to Hiram, a foreigner. In return for Hiram's help with the temple, he gave him some cities, as well as some gold, I think. But Hiram helped with the building of the temple. I don't know whether it's the wood, it might have been, something like that. But he gave away part of the promised land, some cities in it, and so on. So many wives, including foreign ones, pagan altars still, child sacrifice, loads of gold, silver, horses. He actually sold arms to their enemies. That's a way of putting the bit where at some point it says he exported, again to do with Egypt, trading with Egypt. He imported them, and then, that's right, he imported them from Egypt and then exported them on to the Hittites, who were their enemies. So he was buying and selling chariots and horses in order to pass them on to the Hittites, the Aramaeans, and so on. Maybe that's how he got his great wealth, much as anything. So what's the conclusion in all that? difficult, really, perhaps, to sum it up, and I've only given a brief outline of this. He was obviously was wise because God gave him wisdom. And we'll be continuing to look at this as we think about what happens in the Old Testament. But there seems to have been the problem, if I've understood this properly, is that it doesn't work if one person thinks they've got all the wisdom. You know, God made him wise. He needed wise people around him in order to say to him, do you really think that's wise? Or you shouldn't really be doing that. And it's if one person gets all this wisdom and therefore all the power and glory that goes with it, and it goes to their heads, he's not going to listen to anyone else. And part of being wise is actually to recognize wisdom in other people. And so it probably wasn't healthy in the end for any of them, including Solomon himself, for him to be this super wise guy that almost made him feel as though, well, whatever I do must be right then. And it just shows how you can take gifts from God and eventually turn them to your own use rather than God's, for your own glory, or just to make you feel better about things. Did he actually in the end pervert the gift of wisdom that he'd got, that he'd been given by God? Did he use it for his own fame, fortune and wealth and so on? And yet, if the rest of it's right, he did at the same time impress people with genuine wisdom as well. And in back in chapter 4, because I've been sort of dotting around a little bit, when it says his fame spread to all the surrounding nations, he spoke 3,000 proverbs, his songs numbered 1,005, he described plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the walls. That's from the biggest plant to the smallest, the tiny hyssop that you find in the cracks in the walls. He talked about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. In other words, he gained a lot of knowledge about the natural world, and he put a lot of things down in proverbs and songs and so on. So according to the scriptures, he had a legacy of wisdom like that. So as you probably know, and this is what we're coming up to in future weeks, Solomon wrote, or at least collected, a lot of Proverbs. I don't know if Proverbs is a book you ever look at very much, but we're going to look at it, obviously not chapter by chapter, but we're going to consider that. Solomon is also regarded as being responsible for, although we'll see that that might not actually be quite the case, of two other books in the Old Testament. Do you know which other two books are ascribed to him?
Ecclesiastes.
Ecclesiastes, subscribed to him, yeah.
Lamentations?
No, that's Jeremiah.
Song of Solomon.
The Song of Solomon, yes, which actually is the Song of Songs as such. But in a lot of cases, things will be attributed to Solomon because of his reputation without him actually necessarily of putting pen to paper in that way. Clearly he did a lot of songs, 1,005 of them, thousands and thousands of proverbs. We don't have all that many. So somehow something has been preserved for us. So that's the main part of the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. There's another book in the Old Testament which is regarded as a wisdom book that we haven't mentioned just yet. Do you know what that is?
Is it Daniel?
No, an interesting question.
Job?
Because he's not really a prophet. He's in the writings there. No, just want to say it.
Job?
Sorry, I'm still not hearing that.
Job?
Job, yes, that's right. So I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but we're going to have to look at Job as well if we're going to study the wisdom stuff in the Old Testament. Again, not chapter by chapter, but there's one chapter in Job which is dedicated entirely to wisdom. Does anyone know which chapter that is?
Mm.
No? Homework for next time or sometime in the future. Find the chapter in Job that's all about wisdom. And something I've got lined up, which I'll leave till next time now, is there is another book ascribed to Solomon called The Wisdom of Solomon. Do you know The Wisdom of Solomon? That's not in your Bible. Do you know where you do find it?
In the Apocrypha.
It is. It's in what's called the second canon in the Apocrypha. So, yes, I'm actually going to take you outside of the Bible next time and discuss this book, The Wisdom of Solomon, some of the time. I don't know whether you've ever, you may have got a copy of the Apocrypha in your house, or whether you've ever thought about that particular book. There are one or two other books in the Apocrypha that are also wisdom books. Any idea what they are? Does anyone know any other apocryphal books that are devoted to wisdom?
Would that be Enoch?
And the Wisdom of Sirach?
Yeah, not Enoch as such, I don't think. But yes, okay, of Sirach. Any idea who Sirach is and what that's all about?
Nope.
No, thought not. That book's also called Ecclesiasticus. Not the same as Ecclesiastes, but Ecclesiasticus. And you sometimes hear bits read from it. So I'm going to talk about the other Jewish wisdom books that are not in the Bible, just out of interest, but also because they're part of the tradition. And actually, there'll be stuff in there that will make us eventually think about wisdom in the New Testament. And the most important aspect of that is Jesus himself. It's all leading up to eventually Christ, the wisdom of God and the power of God. Okay. So there we are. That's a little taste of what to come. So following on from Solomon, we'll have a look at this book, The Wisdom of Solomon, and then we'll start to look at what else he's attributed to him anyway, and just follow the theme through. So that's what we're going to do for the rest of the 4 or 5 weeks that we have up to Christmas. I think that's everything at this point. John? John, yeah?
Just thinking about Solomon. If there hadn't been a Solomon, there wouldn't have been a Philip and the Ethiopian, which we see in Acts.
Right.
Well, because it was the Queen of Sheba.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Because, and therefore the Ethiopians were Jewish, part Jewish, whatever. As a result of the Queen of Sheba and Solomon.
Oh, I see. Yes. Okay. Yes. In other words, she went back with more than she ended up with. Yeah. There is that idea that they got on really well together in their cozy little chats, and she went back with the child.
I used to live in Yemen.
Yeah.
They absolutely believe it. Well, I was there 78 to 80, so maybe they've changed their minds since then. Archaeological digs done in Marib, which is the border of between the empty quarter of Saudi Arabia and Yemen, I think in the 50s, some archaeologists actually dug out the palace and an enormous dam, which is out in the middle of no water at all for miles and miles and miles. But they believe that is where the kingdom of Sheba was, and that it's went from there all the way over to Ethiopia. It was just that large a kingdom. But certainly there were carvings of, not at all pornographic, they're kind of sweet little carvings of Solomon and Sheba in the sack. And the talk stories about their son Menelik, who went back and taught Judaism, and there were, you know, began the worship of Yahweh.
Yeah.
So certainly Yemeni believe it.
Yeah, well, there's a little verse in 1 Kings 10 where people sort of go, ah, okay, I wonder, where it says, King Solomon gave the Queen of Sheba all she desired and asked for, besides what he'd given her out of his royal bounty. Then she left and returned with her retinue to her own country. So I wonder what it was that she desired and asked for, other than all the gold and silver and so on. But I wonder if she thought, there's something in those jeans, and I don't mean his pants, those jeans, but, you know, in his, I wonder if there's something that will carry through into our children, if only I can persuade him. So there we are. And of course, with already 1,000 wives to choose from, well, why not another little incident like that? But anyway, so yeah, people read that into that verse there, as well as in the other means that you mentioned and so on. Anyway, there we go. So can't promise in which order we're going to do things. And obviously these are big books that we're going to look at, and it's only one evening on each one pretty well. We'll have to sort of cover the main ground fairly, fairly quickly. But I'm assuming that probably you haven't, who's read the whole of the Book of Proverbs recently?
No, not recently.
Recently? How recently then, John and Rose?
It's part of our daily reading process.
Right.
Through the chronology of the Bible.
Yeah.
So within the last few months.
Oh, fairly recently. Okay. Yeah. What about Job? Has that come up recently?
No.
Okay. We won't. What we'll look at with Job is why it's included as wisdom literature, really, without going to all the bits and pieces of it. And, of course, why Ecclesiastes is regarded as wisdom when it's so sort of mournful. But wisdom was a very big thing, probably from Solomon onwards, you know, a really big tradition, shall we say, presumably before that as well. So that Solomon knew to ask for that. I'm not saying he was the only wise person that they'd ever had, but it was certainly something that they eventually regarded very, very highly, that wisdom was something that's so much related to God that you could almost, not surprisingly, eventually say of Jesus, he was the wisdom of God. They were already beginning to think in those terms, but we'll explore that later. Right, I'm going to stop the recording, I think.